You're listening to the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, episode 31. In 1986, Sophie Darlington's curiosity was aroused by Peter Matheson's book, The Tree Where Man Was Born. Shortly after, she arrived at Gibbs Farm Safari Lodge in Tanzania. Whilst there, she ran into Hugh Miles and Keith Scholey, two of the BBC Natural History Unit's finest, who inspired her to become a wildlife filmmaker. In 1990, Sophie was introduced to the legendary wildlife filmmaker Baron Hugo van Lawick, who was, as luck would have it, in need of a camp manager and sound recordist. It turned out he also required a new camera operator. So Sophie studied cinematography for several years under his watchful eye in the Serengeti National Park. Since 1991, Sophie has worked as a filmmaker and cinematographer specializing in natural history in remote locations throughout the world, from 78 degrees south to 78 degrees north, with a whole lot of Africa in between. Her impressive list of credits includes the BBC's Perfect Planet, Seven Worlds and Dynasties, Netflix's Our Planet, as well as National Geographic's Earth Live. Sophie was also part of the core team that won the BAFTA for cinematography in 2016 for the BBC's The Hunt, and she was accepted as a BAFTA member in 2018. In the future, Sophie would like to spend more time promoting the role of camera women in wildlife filmmaking, as well as teaming up with young creatives with an expertise in technology to explore new techniques and alternative avenues for natural history content. Good evening, Sophie. Thank you so much for joining me on the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast this evening. How are you?
I am very well. Thank you for having me along. How are you?
I'm good. I'm great. Thank you. Yeah, my pleasure to have you here. And it looks nice and bright still. Of course, we're getting into spring now, so it's nice and bright there in London. And it's morning, of course, here in Nevada, so we're a few hours apart. But as you're probably aware, with the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, it's all about helping aspiring filmmakers see how the pros in the industry got to where they are and some advice to help them along their way. So I'd love to just get right to the start and find out how you became the camera woman that you are today. How did it all start?
How did it all start? Well, by accident, I think, most probably. I wasn't one of those kids who was enmeshed in worms and dissecting things, but I was a kid that could be found watching light. My thing has always, Jake, been light. I love it. It completely, I see light and I'm just like, you know, I'm drawn to it, moth to a flame. And I think that I left school. I had no idea what I wanted to do, what I wanted to be. I was at sea. I went and worked in a shop. Everybody said, go to art college. And being really sensible, I went, no, not a hope. And I ended up not taking a kind of normal route, but going off to Tanzania. And that doesn't sound like a normal route. I essentially got a break through a friend of a friend of a friend, which is often how these things happen. And at the age of 19, headed off to Tanzania for 3 months. I stayed for 2 years because I fell in love with it. And I was volunteering out there and I met a BBC film crew. And when I met them, it was like, ah, now I know what I want to do. That's it. And so I asked them for a job. And as is traditional with any person that you ask in the business, they say, no, go on.
Right.
They said, go and prove that you're interested, which is actually a really good piece of advice. So I didn't come to it till much later, until I found Hugo van Lawick, who very kindly became my mentor. But it was initially, it was sort of through a sort of like, it's much easier now, I think, to be a wildlife filmmaker. There's loads of courses.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, what I love, it sounds very much like Doug Allen's story as well, meeting the BBC out, you know, out when he was in the Antarctic. I mean, I love that about traveling. You know, I traveled when I was young and so many opportunities opened up to me. And I think, you know, it's one of those things that when you're chasing something so hard, you know, so many people really want a career in something. They chase it so hard. A lot of the time, the opportunities aren't there because they're so tunnel visioned Whereas when we just go off and kind of, you know, explore the world, so much opens up to us. I'm not saying that's the only way to do it, but it sounds like that happened for you. So how old were you when you headed out to Tanzania?
So I was about, I would have been around 19, 18, 19.
Okay.
And I guess the thing was that we were so lucky, Jake, to live in a time where travel, now that we see how difficult travel has become, and also the sort of, the ecological fallout from traveling too. So it was sort of like we lived at a time of ignorance, I guess, and going out to East Africa, going out to Tanzania, I met these incredibly inspiring, I met scientists, I met photographers, I met paleontologists, and it all just sort of, as I say, it just sort of formed this fantastic kind of world in which I was able to go, that's what I want to do. And seeing, I met actually Keith Scholey, who now runs Silverback Films, and also Hugh Miles, who is one of my heroes as a cameraman still to this day, and Adrian Warren. And I asked them for a job, and I still tease Keith and say it took him 25 years to give me one.
Right. That's fantastic. Well, so now you didn't start off though as a camera person, right? You did some other stuff. Is that right? Did you do some sound recording before?
No, I did everything before. I worked in a shop. I worked in an animation company. I worked on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for 2 years back in Dublin whilst I was trying to work out how I could get back to Tanzania. I started in Tanzania as a camp manager. And I made myself really useful. And I think that's something we all know, that if you want to get on, you make yourself useful. You see a gap, you see a hole, and you like, oh, I know, hold on, I can preempt this, I can get involved. And I learned from some amazing people. I were very generous people with their time, sound recording, as you say, spotting, sitting with Hugo, watching, a lot of watching people dissect their rushes, because we had a plethora of camera people who came out, incredibly talented camera people, and every evening, not every evening, because that's what happens now, that we can watch stuff immediately, every couple of months when the VHSs arrived back from Europe,
right.
We'd watch the rushes, and there would be this brilliant moment of critique where Hugo and all the other camera people would critique each other's work, and that was an amazing way to learn. So yeah, I didn't start by being a camera person. With your original and quite good question.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so, you know, learning through watching people like that is so fantastic. I used to do the same thing when I was hosting. I would go and watch the rushes with the cameraman just on the camera every night in a hotel room, and just look at the framing and look and learn that. And I love that creative side so much so, you know, I didn't want to host anymore. I wanted to be behind a camera and work on that creative side because it just pulled me to it. And I heard you say in an interview once that you have an instinctive eye for framing and composition. You look and it's just, it comes instinctively to you. Do you feel like that's always been, or do you think it's actually part of your experience of growing?
No, I think that I'm left-eyed. I'm left-handed very much and left-eyed. And if I try and film with my right eye, it's a disaster. I can't frame things naturally. And
right.
With my left eye, it hurts when they're in the wrong place.
Yeah.
It's sort of, I know when things, and to the detriment sometimes, because I'm so busy framing, I'll in the past, one of the problems was I would be so busy framing, I'd miss the behavior, be like, okay, got to learn not to do that.
Right.
But yeah, so absolutely. And whilst working in Alaska once with a wonderful camera assistant, he was struggling with this still somewhat. And I just said, what eye are you? And he said, what do you mean, what eye are you? And we went through the whole thing, you know, this is how you check your eye. And you know, you close one eye and you know, that thing, you know what to do, Jake.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I was sitting there and I said, you know, put it in the middle and then close the eye. And if it moves, the other eye is the dominant eye, you know, whichever way around it goes. Anyway, he sat there. He'd been using entirely the wrong eye for taking pictures. He swapped to his other eye. He now makes an absolute fortune.
Maybe I should try that. I'm going to try my other eye. As soon as we get off this call, I'm going to check out my eye.
You have one eye that definitely...
Yeah.
But some people, you know, they just, my other half, he, you know, it didn't, wouldn't matter what eye he used. He wouldn't be able to find it to save his life. Luckily, he's brilliant at loads of other things. But, you know, it's some people have that visual acuity.
Yeah.
which obviously you have to have.
And I feel the same. I do. It's the same thing when I'm speaking with my mentees. I have a mentoring group. And when I chat with them, one of the things is it feels right. There's a feeling you get when you frame something up. And when you've been filming, say, a sequence and you're on the long end of the lens and you're pulling out wide and you're finding, and then suddenly it feels different. You've just suddenly framed a beautiful shot and you know it. And it's not because you look at it and you go, oh, this is a beautiful shot. It's just that feeling. You just go, this is it. And you stay on it and you follow it and it's great. And I mean, I always say that, you know, when I go back and look at my rushes, I probably find, and I shouldn't say this probably, but when I go back through them, I probably find that like 10 to 20% are beautiful shots like that. And then the rest is usable stuff, but it just doesn't have that incredible beauty as some of those, you know, detailed shots that just really, really work. Yours, I'm hoping are much higher.
No, not at all. Because you've got to keep in mind the sequence, and sometimes you have to sacrifice perfection for the behavior, because ultimately we're there to tell a story. And yes, I believe that, you know, that when you frame something and it's exquisite and it moves you and it's very beautiful, then that's a great thing. But also sometimes you have to let go of that and concentrate, because if you don't have the shot in big close-up of, you know, whatever it might be, the animal looking that way, which may not be perfect, but you might only have one chance to get it. If you don't get that, you've got no story. Yeah. So it's about sort of like, I would say I get one shot a shoot that makes me really like go boom. And if I get the one, then I'm happy. And then I'll get hopefully lots and lots that are usable and useful for the story and will drive the story. But if I come away without getting one that makes my heart sing, I'll be disappointed.
Sure. Oh, well, that's interesting. Yeah, I think then I'm on the right track.
100% way ahead of me.
But now if you are, it's great bringing up the whole sequencing and storytelling, because of course that is what it's all about. And, you know, I think we've all seen beautifully shot films that have zero story and are just unwatchable. And then we've seen stuff that has fantastic story with very mediocre camera work, you know, whether it's Hollywood films or whatever, but it's watchable because you're following the story. And getting that sweet spot of getting a great story and great camera work is just, you know, that's what we're all aiming for, right? So if you were to explain to people new to this industry, wanting to be a camera person, in terms of, you know, learning the camera, learning the you know, their gear and how to frame and composition and all of that kind of stuff, compared to learning sequencing and storing, what would you say is more important? Where should they spend most of their time?
That's a great question. I would imagine that if I was going to give advice, and the advice I always try and I think is most useful, is that give yourself a very short amount of time to tell a story. So say, for instance, someone's listening and they're wanting to put together a showreel, Jay, and they want to make that showreel, tell a story, make it short because nobody has any time, but think about what shot sizes will make you engage. And so when you're filming, it's really, really important to engage with your subject and to make it's really difficult to explain, but you want to engage people by, there's a saying, can I swear?
No, absolutely.
Mid shot is like a shit shot, right? Yeah. It's like, we don't want to give mid shots. And the only reason a mid shot is acceptable, and when I say a mid shot, I mean, I'm in a mid shot in this frame now. I am neither big nor small. This would only be an interesting shot if something was happening within it, if there was amazing behavior being told. So if I was an up and coming camera person, I would be concentrating on both story and also varying my shot size. Make sure that you go very wide and tell people where you are. Make sure you're going super tight, so who you're looking at. And there are so many tricks, but I think that use your voice, see what you see and make it individual. You don't have to copy other people's work. I think, you know, you can tell as interesting a story about a pigeon. I can see a pigeon, great, in London, very few of them, but I've got the fattest pigeon in the world that comes to my roof, and I could tell a really fabulous little story about this pigeon just because he's so comical and plump, and he's totally and utterly worked out how to get into my bird feeder. And so it's the but he's the only one in the whole neighborhood who comes. You know, if I had that big close-up of him pecking in the things, of him sitting on my fence, and then him flying in and out, I could tell a great little story if I chose the right light. I just don't try and copy other people. Do your own thing. Yeah. Use your own voice. I'm going all over the place because it's quite difficult to pinpoint it.
It is, and it was a big question. I mean, it is one of those things that it's interesting you say that about the pigeon, because I remember being at Jackson Hole Wildlife Film Festival back in 2017, and there was a film, I don't remember the name of it, but it was about pigeons in Paris. And nice. It was a film, and
oh,
it was beautiful.
Do you?
Yeah. And it was beautifully shot. Great film about pigeons. And so many people ask me, they say, well, you know, what am I? There's no way I can compete in this industry because, I'm not in the Serengeti, or I'm not, you know, I live in a town where we don't have any wildlife. And I say, look, there's wildlife everywhere. You know, you just have to, whether it's about, you know, a colony of ants in the sidewalk, there's a story waiting to be told, and it's how you do it. And exactly.
How you use your creativity. There's a wonderful young camera person coming up, Yuzuru, and he came having spent, we talked for a couple of years about his work, and he would send stuff and he listened, and he, you know, it started off mid shots and by the end of it was beautiful, but he did all of his work pretty much standing in a pond in the Regent's Park, which is in the center of London, filming some stunning grebes. And he did it, you know, it was his creativity and his way of looking at the story from a slightly from his perspective. Yeah. But it was a story. It had, you know, and a story is what grabs us, as you said so rightly. If it's got no story, it's just a bunch of images and it's a chocolate box. What's fun about that?
Yeah. And in this day and age, we can all pretty much now afford a camera that can take an incredible image. You know, we're not limited anymore by the gear. We're limited by our creativity and the story that we can tell. So that's fantastic. So I want to go back a little bit too. So you were in Tanzania. You're now working in the industry. You're filming and doing everything else. What was the big stepping stone from that point on there that really cemented you as a camera woman?
Well, I was very, very lucky to have the backing of Hugo van Lawick, actually, who really was an ally to so many of us. And he championed us and he gave us opportunities. So a film would come up and I got my first ever film, having only really assisted. And I mean, I'd been working for 3 years, don't get me wrong, for no money at all, like you do when you're happy to learn something.
Yep,
you know.
Yep.
But he had been watching my rushes, and for whatever reason he felt I was able to take on a film myself. So I think that was my massive step. I was very lucky to be working with Patrick Morris, a very experienced producer, and with another cameraman, Gus Christie. But we made a film about lions, and it was shot on film, which was way back when. And it took a year and a half to make. And I got nominated for cinematography at Wild Screen at it. It was the first film I'd ever, ever done. I was up against Owen Newman, who is the god, you know. He was just, he's such an amazing camera person. And that got my name on them, you know, that was my leap up to then people sort of getting in touch and saying, oh, actually, I think she's not actually doing this, because unfortunately, when I started, if you got maybe as a woman, if you got into this, there was often a thing, there was an undercurrent that you got this gig because you were a woman. Yeah. And what was lovely to be nominated was, it wasn't because I was a woman, it was because the work we provided was beautiful and it was fantastic. And I remain incredibly proud of our film to this day. So that was my big leap.
Well, and that's fantastic. But let's make it clear here. That was your first film that you filmed, and you won an award, but you had been working. You got nominated. I would have given you the award, but there
you
we go.
Yeah.
But let's be clear here. You were working for years and years at this before
years.
That, right? Years and years.
Years and years of just watching and learning and earning very little money. But I didn't care, because what I wanted to do was be out in the field. And I was incredibly privileged because I was able to live in Serengeti on and off for 7 years, which was, you know, that doesn't happen anymore. It just doesn't. So I lived at a time where that was practical. I mean, it happens very rarely. There are some people who come up and you see them. But as I say, when I was doing it, there was the National Film and Television School, which Justine Evans went through, But really, that was it. There was very little else. Whereas now, there is just a plethora of incredible schools and teaching that goes on. You can learn online from people like yourself. You know, that's an amazing resource. Or many other camera people who are, you know, there's a lot of places you can go and learn from. Excuse me, the local jazz bar has just started up. I don't know if you can hear it.
I can hear it in the background. I thought you had maybe a party going on and you were about to return to
that's
it.
London.
Now, of course, you're now a huge inspiration to other women looking to do this. You are. You're a massive inspiration to everyone, let alone just women. But you are, because I know lots of women who are looking to get in as producers, directors, camera women. There's so many opportunities in this industry, especially now, because the industry is really growing as a whole. Mm-hmm. What advice? Well, first of all, before we go into the advice, what I really want to know is, for you as a woman moving up in this industry, how hard was it for you in a male-dominated industry throughout the last, you know, however many decades? Did you find it held you back in any way, shape, or form to be a woman? Or did you find that because of your skill set, it didn't really matter?
Working with Hugo, I hit a very lucky thing, because I think Hugo gave me an opportunity and there was never any other agenda other than he saw talent and passion. I think that a lot of other people I know have had different journeys and it hasn't been that way. So I'm also huge, by the way, I'm 6 foot. No, not huge, tall, sorry. I'm very tall. and so therefore I think that I can hold my ground. When I'm meeting people, it's not like I'm little. I'm able to look a lot of men in the eye, if not at the top of their heads.
Sure.
So I think that maybe I'm a bit scary. Who knows? I'm not quiet. I'm quite outspoken as well. And I think that so I've been really fortunate. But also, I'd just like to say, I don't know how many jobs I haven't got because I was a woman. But I'm sure there were plenty.
Yeah.
And it's really good that the industry now is changing and actively addressing the imbalance in craft. And you very kindly said that I was an inspiration. I would love it if other people got into, whoever they might be, get into this industry because they see someone who doesn't look like possibly the norm, who looks like someone other than what we've been presented with for however many years. And actually, wouldn't it be great to, as you know, I'm very, very keen now to use my position and my privilege to help diversity, because we are, you know, there are people of, you know, Black people, brown people, there are very few people who don't look like us who are in this industry. So now it's next steps. We've got women are coming in. That's fantastic. That's brilliant. Now we need to shift on. And let's get people in the countries we're going to and filming with actually behind the cameras. That's the next mission.
That's fantastic. And I think, again, it's a beautiful time for it, because natural history TV is growing. I think it slumped there for a while when we were kind of testing out the reality TV and all of those different genres. But, blue chip shows are back up and, there's just so much natural history TV being made and so many platforms for it now. And of course, you have worked on most of the landmark series across these. You've worked for Discovery, National Geographic, BBC. You've worked pretty much for everyone, I believe. Am I wrong?
I've worked for Disney, Discovery, Netflix, BBC. It's a dream. It really is a dream. As a kid, you know, when I was starting out, I couldn't imagine how I'd ever work for anybody, because I worked for a Dutch company and we worked for Discovery. That's all I ever worked for. As I said, it took me 25 years to get my first gig almost with the BBC.
Right.
Forever. Because it's not an easy business to get into, but talent will out, hopefully. And again, I think that now with the young filmmakers, getting your stuff seen is so much easier, because all they need to do is contact any one of us and send us a short showreel and we'll watch it. And if we think they're any good or worth mentoring, we'll help, you know. Yeah. I'm a great believer that the more talent we have in the industry, the stronger we shall be. And therefore, the more people are going to watch us, the more relevant. The more people we bring in, the more relevant we'll become. So, you know, welcome all to all talent, because that's how we're going to regain our strength and actually get people to listen to our messaging which is why we are all in it, isn't it?
Which is absolutely a great segue to impact. So from your standpoint, what is wildlife film to you? What do you hope to achieve with wildlife natural history films?
Well, it's changed. I think as a kid, I went into it because I just loved the lifestyle and the filming, and it was wonderful. But as the years have gone by, of course, I've become more and more entangled in it. And I feel like that now, actually, the only reason I can possibly do it is that if we can address the climate crisis in whatever way that takes, I will not be involved in chocolate box filmmaking anymore. I'm not going to just go and put out stuff that's pretty to look at. There has to be a reason why we make our films. It doesn't mean they have to all be dreich and dour and hard, but it does mean that if we're going out there, every trip I do now, and I think all of us do now, we see it. It's there. It's not miles away. It's there. And I recently was filming a creature that there are only 400 of them left in the world, right? Wow. 400. Yeah. So I might be one of the few people who will ever get an opportunity to film this animal before it goes extinct. The responsibility that you do this right and proper and make people give a damn is so huge. So I think this isn't a job to be taken. It's not to kind of like, wait, you know, there's that 10 minutes of absolute, tosh at the end of those films where everybody's sort of like, it's all about glamorizing what we do. That's not relevant anymore. Yeah. It's about telling the truth, but telling the truth in a way that makes people engage. So it means everything to me, actually, Jake, everything.
Well, and I think that the industry has changed so much in the last few years. I mean, the word conservation used to be a dirty word, right? Network TV.
You couldn't sell anything. Hey?
No. Yeah. And now, of course, we have so many different platforms, and some platforms are certainly way more into having programs of impact. Some are still very much entertainment based and are kind of hesitant, but we're in a place where we now have the opportunity to make those films and have a platform for them and pitch them. I mean, I remember years ago pitching stuff for conservation and it just, you know, being thrown out the door. Now, of course, it's really about, okay, what's the story? You know, what is the story here? Can it inspire people?
Well, you see The Octopus Teacher, you know, it wins an Oscar because it inspired people. It had a really beautiful story. It wasn't particularly, you know, it was a really simple and beautiful story, really well told. And it got to people's hearts, you know, it really did. And it's just like, I love it because for years I've been going, I'm not eating an octopus because they're too bloody clever. I won't, I shan't. You know, anyone who can predict the World Cup, no, not even.
Right.
And now there's just like a load of people going, oh, actually, squid octopus can do it. I'm like, yes, come on. And that wasn't an overt message.
Right.
It was just by making people care.
Yes. Brilliant. And I had this conversation the other day with someone about who used to eat those mini octopuses, you know, that would come on top of the soup. And I had the exact same, they watched the show and I said, you know, would you eat an octopus now after seeing this? And they're like, well, you know, probably not. And as you say, that was not the message. It wasn't about not eating shark fins or octopus or, you know, it was just the connection that person had that suddenly made you think twice.
Brilliant. Yeah, it's great. And I love the fact that shows are now, it's becoming an absolute, it has to be on the table. We can't ignore it. I love that.
Yes. Yeah. That's fantastic. Now, a big question that I get quite a lot is that when you're in the industry, I mean, most camera people are freelancers, right? I'm not sure there are many people in the industry who are at full time for a network. Mm-hmm. How easy is it to continue getting work, or what stage is it along your career path where you don't have to worry anymore because the work just keeps coming in?
That doesn't ever work like that. I mean, there will be times where what you do is popular, and there will be times when it will be less popular. And to do this job, you have to have a backbone, and you have to have resourcefulness and resilience and get out there and pick yourself up when you haven't worked. I had a child when my career was just about to take off, and brilliant, lovely, you know, how and ever try and work with a small baby. It doesn't happen. You've got kids. It's really tough as a man. I don't know. Most of my friends who are cameramen say, you know, that leaving the kids was one of the worst things they ever had to do, because we miss out on huge chunks of our children's lives. However, it's a choice that we all make. It's just that I think women talk about it most probably more than men. But I think that with my son, there was, you know, there were years where I didn't work. Years.
Right. Yeah.
And so much so that when I finished, I stopped work. I was filming on film. And when I came back, I was filming on beta tape. Yeah. And I had no idea. I was used to like 10 minutes of a can. And I went to 45 minutes and pre-roll. I'm like, well, this is fantastic.
Let's take another decade off.
What I'm planning on to later. But I love it. The advances in tech are absolutely fantastic at the minute. But yeah, so it's, as a freelancer, it's tough. Reality is it's tough. And it never, you know, yes, there will be a few people who never stop working. You've got to find a balance, though, because you've got to have a life. I've got a partner. I've got a kid. I've got friends, you know, and I don't want to be away.
They're not all in the Antarctic, are they?
They aren't. There's a few of them there now.
Okay.
Absolutely.
No, you know, I've spoken about this before. I think with Nate Dappin, I was chatting about this, and he's the happy father of two new twins and his, I think, 2 or 3 year old daughter now as well. And just the challenge and finding that work-life balance, because it is something that actually I took very, very seriously. I didn't want to miss out. And so I stopped doing far off travel and I started to build a career around local nonprofits and doing things like this, you know, doing at kind of finding other ways to outsource and create other business ideas. And really, that's what's great about being a freelancer is you have those opportunities. You're not kind of stuck. But I did that because I wanted to make the choice of not being away from my kids. So I know a lot of people I've spoken to, Doug Allen, I think one of them, being away so, so much. As you say, it takes a toll. One way or another, you have to make choice. It's a very difficult thing to do.
And there's not a right or a wrong, by the way, Jake, either. But it is something to consider that this is not whether you're a man, a woman, or another, whoever, you know, another. You. It's you know, it's something you have to think about.
It is. And as you say, there's no right or wrong. It's what makes you happy. And I think that's probably the key over all of it is, what do you want from life, right? What do you want? Where do you want to be? Do you want to make impactful films and just focus on that and not have a family and go and do that 100% of your time? Or do you want to try and do a bit of both and dabble here and there? And you know, I always look at, I just turned 50 this year. I'm dabbling at life all the time, right? That's all I ever really do. I can't call this a career. I call it dabbling.
Well, I don't think you have a career. I think you have a life. I don't believe that, you know, this is it, people. I think this last year has shone a light on that very heavily. And we've all, you know, I don't know about, you know, last year, 9 months, no work because of COVID, obviously. And many people had it much, much worse. So I've got nothing to moan about.
Sure.
But I would say that you have to have a resourcefulness and a self, what do you call that thing where it's all, you know, you have to generate your own.
Your own motivation.
Exactly. I think you have to be very self-motivated. Well done.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So what is the typical, obviously last year was definitely not typical. What would, and there may not be a typical, but what would, if there is a typical year be in the life of Sophie Darlington? How many months would you say on average that you are away a year?
I'd love to work for 6 months a year, 6 to 8 months, and then have, you know, 6 to 4 months at home. But also when I'm at home, I got asked today, how was my holidays? It's like, are you mad? You know, as a freelancer, you never have holidays because you're always like, you know, you're putting momentum into the next project. You're researching, you're talking about future projects. You're feeding back. You never stop.
So
holidays are something you go on. Which you know, I haven't been on in a while. I don't know about you. I don't think anybody has.
Not for a very, very probably about a decade. It's one of those things as a freelancer, it sets you back. I mean, when you stop at whatever, you know, however much, if you stop for 2 weeks, you're literally 2 weeks behind, aren't you? Because you've got to keep stuff, you know, ticking over.
Absolutely. It's constant discussions and it's fantastic. And also you right now, especially, you have to hold on to things quite lightly. So you might be told about something in a year in advance. You'll have fantastic discussions with the production people, with the producers. Usually it started off with the producer directors. They'll contact you. Would you like to do the sequence? They'll go into the sequence a bit. You'll look at your diary. Yes, it works. It's great. Then you start into the logistics. You think about what kit, what you can bring to the shoot, how you can tell the story maybe in a different way that they haven't thought about. And then you'll do like, you know, so it'll be, you know, loads of different phone calls. And then a month before you go, they'll ring you up and go, look, the behavior didn't happen this year, so we're canning the shoot. And that's it. Yeah. Goodbye. See you later. So it's, so you hold things quite lightly,
yeah,
but put all your passion into them.
And hopefully have multiple things working,
yes,
at the same time. So when those things do drop by the wayside, you can just start focusing on the next one. And
yeah, but not taking, not saying yes to multiple things. That's bad. I don't like, sure, that.
Right.
I don't, yeah, like that. I, you know, if I say yes to someone, I say yes to someone. And if a better gig comes along, then I say no, because actually, yeah, I've said yes. You've got to be honorable. And
oh, absolutely. Well. Integrity in this industry is everything. 100%. Yeah.
I think so. It's your reputation. Hey.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. So how important is networking for you, Sophie, in terms of the film festivals and going out and networking? You're at the top of your game, right? You're filming these landmark series that, you know, we all see across all platforms. A lot of people would think at this point, Sophie's just sitting, I mean, you've told us you're not, but you're sitting at home with your legs crossed, you know, and having a glass of wine, waiting for the next gig that you're, you know, you're out on. How important is it? Do you still network as hard as you did, say, 20 years ago?
See, I've never been very good at networking, which is part, okay, of my problem. But what I have got, and I think what this industry is wonderful at, is it's such a small industry, Jack, as you know. It's, yep, so small that I have a lot of friends. And so when you go to something like Jackson Wild or Wild Screen or whatever it might be, I was at a wonderful event a couple of years back called Women in Nature, I think it was, a wildlife film festival in,
yeah,
Perpignan. And there were just a rake of all these wonderful people that I knew from other work, you know, and so I don't know. I think it's quite good to remind people that you're still alive,
right,
and that you're still working, and that, and people, out of sight is out of mind. So it's sort of like keeping that, yeah, balance. I need to learn about networking. So if you suss it out, let me know. I'm,
yeah,
not,
yeah, fair enough. I am terrible at it as well. And what I've learned for me is that I just show up. And I've taken all the other pressure off, because it used to be, you know, I mean, like when you're new at anything, right, you turn up and you've got your business cards and you've got, and you're desperately, you're feverishly out there with a list of people you're trying to meet. And then after a while you go, yeah, this isn't how to do it. This is not how it works. And most of the great conversations, or even the meetings that turn into work, are when you bump into someone and spill coffee over them and then end up drinking the coffee with them. And
the coffee spilling technique.
Well, I just throw it at people now.
Going around now, slinging buckets of coffee on everyone.
Right.
But I do think in the, you know, it's at breakfast at those festivals when you, yeah, have a chat. And Wild Screen and Jackson Wild do it brilliantly. That they had networking breakfast at Jackson Wild a couple of years back. And it was so fabulous because you sat with a bunch of incredibly interesting people, and you all, yes, shared and swapped stories. And that's one of the things that this year has given me, which I blooming adore, is mentoring. So I've been remote mentoring in Kenya and in a little bit in Tanzania and elsewhere, and also on-site mentoring. And I was always scared of mentoring because I was like, how do you mentor? What do you do? And,
sure,
as it turns out, you have conversations. And that's mentoring. I'm like, oh my God, I love it.
Yes. Yeah.
And so that's, this last year has been an absolute revelation for me in terms of working with incredibly interesting and talented people, because it's a two-way street.
Yes.
And I'm getting as much out of it as they are, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I started a group up last year. It's coming up to being a year young now.
Wow.
And I was the same, you know, it was very intimidating starting it, but I knew there was a big need because I had lots of people.
How did you start it? Did you start it through this?
No, I started it. Well, this is part of it, if you like, but no, I just started it online, advertising on social media as a mentoring group online. And weekly Q&As. So we literally, you know, we meet on a Facebook group every Tuesday morning, and I, nice, answer questions. And,
nice,
what's fantastic is we've got people from multiple countries around the world. And they're all part of the group. So they're all helping each other, answering each other's questions, as well as, you know, me answering live questions every Tuesday. And it's phenomenal because it's like a tribe. They're your people. You know, we all have the same things in common. We're all after the same goals. And we're all helping each other. I mean, I'm learning as much as they are, which is fantastic.
Of course we are. And if you're close to that, well, you're in Egypt.
Yes.
You need absolutely. It's got to be, we've got, that's how we're going to move forward in this industry and grow.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, okay, moving on to gear. Do you have a set package that you take everywhere with you, or are you taking networks packages that you're, how does
I
that work?
I wish I'd bought my own package. That would have been so clever. Actually, no. Oh. Dudley Allen, years ago, I was at that Wild Screen many moons ago when I got nominated. And I went up to Dougie, who was sort of like, Dougie, you know, he was one of the few people I knew. And he was so approachable. And I said, look, what shall I do? Shall I buy a kit? And he said, well, have you been getting work, Soph, without a kit? And I went, yes. And he said, nah, don't. He said, save your money. And thank goodness, because then all the Aries just got used as expensive doorstops.
Yes.
But kit was much more expensive then than it is now. Yeah. I have a preferred kit that I use. You know, a camera, be it an Arri or a Red, usually, or a Phantom.
Yeah.
And then, but I do night filming too. I'm trying to do as much as I can. I'm learning at the minute, GSS, Shotover.
Shotover, I was going to ask about that.
By the way, can I just say, there's a myth that you have to be a gamer and have done this since 8. Yeah. Turns out I'm 54 and you just need to be able to frame and have a little bit of dexterity. Yes, I'm no Tom Walker or Jamie McPherson, but I can do it.
Sure. Yeah. And you'll just get better with time. I mean, it's, as you say, it's just practice. A learned.
Practice makes perfect. But yes, yeah. I do. I have a CN20. I have a Ronford Baker Atlas 40. I have Sackler DA150s and a Red or an Arri, French flag, and off I go. And I'm happy as a bee.
You're good to go. Fantastic. And are you filming? I get asked this a lot as well, but in my experience, filming with people like the BBC, they're still, you know, taking 4K. I've heard a lot that that's 8K across the board. Now everyone's after 8K. It's 8K. But on most of the discussions I have, 8K is extremely large to be storing. And so much of the time, they do not want 8K archival footage. So what is it? Where are you most of the time? What kind of codec and resolution?
It depends. I go on whatever the production asks for.
Sure.
But because the CN20 can't do beyond 7.5, I'm rarely above that. But, you know, 7, if I'm on a Red, if I'm on an Arri, I'm happy because the pixels are large and it doesn't matter. Let's not forget that the pixels are all, you know, you could go down a whole pixel spiral.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it's about size, not quantity.
Yeah, there you go.
It's about the information that fits in that pixel. So if you've got a camera that has very, very large pixels, you're going to get much more information into that, much more, you know, subtlety and color and what that's going on. So I'm no tech geek. I just know. That looks great. That looks great.
Sure. Yeah.
Networks set what they want and you don't have any choice.
You don't. Exactly.
But they'll accept a certain percentage of 2K or even HD if you're
sure.
You know, if you've got a piece, if you've got a lion backflipping and smacking a flamingo around the head, you could shoot it, you know, quite happily on a phone at HD and they'll take it.
Yes. Yeah. It's all about behavior, right? I'm still selling. You know, it's high def, it's handy cam stuff that I filmed of black bears roaming around neighborhoods. And I still sell that stock footage on a regular basis because of the behavior in it. And no one cares. No one ever asks what it was shot on. They just look at it and go, we want that. You know, when can you get it to us?
Brilliant.
Which is fantastic.
So I think that's right. I mean, and if you're working for a network, they'll tell you what they want and you have no choice. So,
yes. Yeah. Fantastic. So you're on the CN20. I don't know whether you saw, we had Ivo Nuremberg on the podcast talking about the CN20 and his role in getting it into fruition. And so that's your main kit. Would you say you're filming on that most of the time?
Oh, I mean, long lens is my deal.
Yeah.
But I, as I said, I'm, you know, even in the shot over the GSS, I'm using it in the gimbal,
yes.
The 720, because it's the one that, for me, it has the perspective of this 50 to 1,000 or 1,500 at the top end of it.
Yeah.
What it does is it brings you into a different world. And it, unlike a prime, which obviously is, you know, when you watch, you know, movies and the primes are all about a different way, because you can be so proximate. What I love about a CN is it enables me to be far away for the animal to do what it does without me impacting it in any way whatsoever. And so I'm able to get that behavior where it's behaving entirely naturally. And also, I just love the way a long lens makes things look. And if I'm doing an interview, I will often do it on the CN and will make the person sit miles away.
Yes, yeah. I do that often with, you know, just using a 200 mil, Canon 200 mil lens and just, you know, crush that background. It looks beautiful. Yeah.
It looks amazing.
Yes, for sure. Oh, that's fantastic. So one of my questions was, are you diversifying in terms of your experience with all of this new technology, you know, drones
Absolutely.
And shot overs? Because I know that they're being used so heavily now within all these productions. So, tell us a bit more about the shot over and just the roles that you're looking for it to kind of fill. Because I know most of the stuff we see you doing is long lens stuff. I mean,
I only done one job on shot over. I'm literally just beginning. I've done my training and my, you know, and I love that. Old dogs, new tricks. We can do it.
Yep.
And I'm curious. I want to know about it. But also it's becoming, as you say, you know, the use of tech, drones, you know, whatever it might be, people are expected to have much more of a breadth in their technology than we would have in the past, because obviously we were limited by speed of film stock, et cetera, whereas now we've got, you know, we've got mad ISOs, we can shoot on a moonlit night. We can shoot with a Ronin, with a gimbal on a car. And it's all the thing that I absolutely I think is really important is that we use all this tech to tell a story, as opposed to using the tech so we can show off what we
can
do.
For the sake of it. Sure.
And there's a real danger of that. Do you remember that time when the Phantom first came out and everything was like it had
2000
Yeah. You remember? Everything was just like,
2,000 frames a second. Yeah.
Everything was just like, oh my God, it's so boring.
Yeah.
And then last year, everything was drone. And then, you know, and the gimbal, everything is Ronin. And it's like, sometimes I don't want to spin around an animal just for the sake of it.
Yes.
Why am I spinning around it?
Yeah.
Use your tech to tell a story. And then it becomes truly exciting and magical.
I think there is this danger that what we're doing is we're replacing behavior with technology, right?
Yeah.
Instead of waiting to get those incredible behavioral shots that tell the story, instead we'll just go in slow motion around an animal, make it look cinematic. Great, there's, you know, 25 seconds taken up. Let's move on. And you're in danger of losing the story if not careful. I think we've seen that with, as you say, slow motion, time lapse was a big one when the Starry Night. You remember that Starry Nights were in like every other shot, transition, Starry Night.
Like anything, there's a fashion, you know, there's an absolute fashion and you know, and who knows where is it going? I think it's exciting. I think tech is wonderful. I personally, I'm not a fan of being aware of tech when I'm watching. It takes me out of that world. When I'm watching something, I want to be immersed in it. I want that story. I want to feel like I'm not there. And the minute I feel a bit of tech that's sort of like, oh my God, I'm going along with, you know, with a something along, you know, I've got a June buggy and it's going with this animal and it's like, it's a gadget, stop it.
Yeah.
But if it's going along at a certain, and there's a reason why it's going along, then great.
Brilliant. But as you say, if the story has got you captivated so that you're not thinking about it, it's when you lose that thread and now you're just worrying about the images. And of course, being camera people, we have a tendency to do that anyway and dissect things. You know, it can be hard sometimes.
Absolutely.
Right. Just watching something for the sake of watching it, right? But I mean, something like My Octopus Teacher was great for that because it was a different story. And it did, for me, it certainly made me come out of, you know, keep thinking about the shots and things like that and just think about what, this, and very relatable stories as well, a human story, you know, a wildlife story.
It's well worth watching Roger Horrocks, the cinematographer. talking about it on Red. I think there's a great interview on Red with him. And he talks so beautifully about his choice of lens and how he wanted it to blend with, you know, the main man. And, you know, how there was such thought. And I don't think you get a chance, you know, often to hear about people speaking emotionally why they're choosing. I know why I choose the CN20 and why I go at certain focal lengths, because it emotionally, it, we talked about it earlier. It's right. It's just
yes.
right.
Yeah.
You know, but listen to that one. It's a fantastic, there's some fabulous resources out there.
There really are.
For learning about why people are choosing the lenses they're using and the light that they're using and the, the tech.
I'll look that up. Yeah. No, and it's great. I love just talking about that because I think it does, you know, one of the things that I find is that it brings us back to basics, I think, as well. Because when you go back and watch some older stuff, you can really see just how simple shots work so effectively when they're telling the story that, as you say, you know, you can over, I mean, I think we are at this hump where we're starting to get over the tech a little bit. Drones have been in now, and now they're, you know, pretty much everyone can afford a drone now of some description.
Right.
And we're
the
getting
modification of the aerial, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, they, all of these things have a great reason to tell, to be used to tell a story. But as you say, I mean, like you can establish with a drone and then get down and tell the story rather than a drone, you know, then another shot, then a time lapse, and now a drone, another time lapse, another drone shot, you know, and then going back and forward between the two. But story is
great. Sorry to interrupt, but there's a great film I saw about, it's about sheep in the Lake District, and it's entirely shot on drone, apart from a few shots on a sheep and on a shepherd. And actually, it's slow TV, so it's very, very clever. Because so it, again, it's about stories. So they use drones, but in a way that you just go into the world of drone and you get used to it, and it becomes, as opposed to becoming a trick.
Yes,
it's actually a story tool. So we'll try and remember the name of the Great Mountain Sheep Gather, possibly. Fabulous little film. If you haven't heard of that, just remember.
Yeah,
really good.
Well, again, you know, if it's captivating, it works. And I think that goes back to what you were saying earlier about do your own thing. You know, if you can find a way to creatively tell a story that's different, and it can be hard, because I think, you know, another question I get an awful lot is, you know, what can I do that hasn't already been done? And it's a great question, because so, you know, so much of the wildlife in the world has been filmed, the great spectacles, many times. Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm just going, do they ever think when they're asking you that if you knew that, you'd do it yourself?
Right.
It's just like, well, let me just give you a few ideas and off you run.
That's right.
You get productions who ring you up and go, so what's the film you'd really like to tell? It's like, what? Just don't know.
Yes, exactly.
I'm just giving you your film. Your own film.
Yes, exactly.
If I can think of that, I'll make it myself. Thanks ever so much.
Well, I think that's why, I mean, what that's a great way to get into how today we're in such a great place. Earlier, you mentioned how easy it is now for filmmakers to get their stuff seen. And I think, you know, the fact that Patrick Dykstra, who I had on the podcast a while back, he worked on Blue Planet, did some of the whale shots on there. His footage of, I think it was humpback whale behavior, was seen on Vimeo by BBC researchers. And then they reached out to him. And now he travels the world as a camera person, filming whale research, right?
Lovely.
And and so much of the time when I'm speaking with researchers, I ask them, you know, where are you getting your stories? And they're like, we literally are searching YouTube, Vimeo, and we're finding what people are doing. And I'm like, that's the first time in history that that was possible, right? In that way, where they just have this ability to reach out to average Joe, you know, on the street with a camera because they may have filmed something not seen before. And then it starts a whole new thing. So
and all it takes is one person to send it to one person who thinks it's good. And then you're in. You're in the door.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Because, but what I think one of the things that we, and I'm sure you get it too, but a lot of things get sent to us, which are 15, 20 minutes long. And it's, they haven't thought about that thing about every single frame has to be there for a reason. Don't put stuff in, you know, if they're doing showreels, if they put in a, you know, they went on holiday and they dove, you know, they did some diving and it's beautiful, but it's not good enough. Don't put it in. I don't care. Nor do you. You know, we care about the story about fat pigeon.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's the seeing the creativity behind what's going on with the image, for sure. I mean, it's, you say, it's too easy these days just to point a camera and get a shot. But what's it? What's its point?
Yeah.
So, okay, I'm not going to ask you what is the show that you most want to film and steal your idea and run off and film it.
I'm working on it right now.
But yeah, there you go. Perfect. But what I will ask you is two things. First of all, most incredible experience you've had filming. What would you say? Is there one thing? I know you've done so much, and that's a hard question, but if you could do it again, what would one of those things be?
I can't possibly, because what I tell you today will be different the next day and the next day and the next day. But, you know, today, the first thing I'm going to tell you, pigeons are blooming marvelous. No, I think that there have been moments that I have sobbed because I have been, and simple moments like on our planet, we were filming sandhill cranes. I was at the top of a tower. I was by myself. I'd been there. I'd gone in. I don't know. I think I'd been sleeping on the floor and I crawled in before dawn and the light came up and the birds started waking up on the river. And there must have been 300,000 sandhill cranes below me, just like on this braided river. And the light was just exquisite. And they lifted up and it was one of those moments. It was the noise. It was the, often you're on your own. You're by yourself. They're very personal moments. And especially as a long lens camera person, you kind of tend to not work with many people around you. But just remember the feeling of all these birds and that sense of, without being deathly dull, but really privileged that I was sitting there and my heart literally, I felt bigger than my body because I was so, my eyes were so happy. My ears were happy. I knew I was at the right place at the right time. It was that. And that sequence, it's at the end of Freshwater in Our Planet. I bloody love it. It's such a, nothing happens. So there's no story there at all, apart from the conservation story.
Yeah.
But everything about filming that was amazing. But then, you know, that's the filming the bear, when the bear comes hoofing past you, there's the, you know, being stuck with a bunch of, you know, a quarter of a million penguins in Antarctica when you're by yourself and you look around and it's just you and one other person for hundreds of miles. Wow. You know, we have such luxury and privilege in our lives. There's an awful lot of sitting at customs,
sure,
and in economy, by the way. I've got long legs. I said I was tall. It hurts physically. There's a lot of, you know, not washing and eating rubbish and being uber tired, but you don't remember any of that. You remember the lift off of those cranes.
And that's the beautiful thing. It's those moments. There's not many jobs. I mean, I've done a lot of jobs in my time, and there's not many jobs that give you that moment of sheer bliss when something like that happens. You say that makes it all worth it. I mean, all of the hardships that those moments make it worth it, that you know you're on the right path to doing what you want to be doing. And speaking of hardships, the hardest thing you've ever done, the hardest thing that you remember that was probably the worst part of what you do,
I think,
just to give some perspective.
Well, no, the honesty is that I again, on Our Planet, when we went to film the polar bears in Canada, and there was a team of us, four of us, we went up, we were fully prepared, we were fully convinced that we were going to smash this sequence, we were going to get behavior that had been filmed, but not, you know, with the resources that we had, we were going to nail this. Months and months, years of preparation by the production people and with us. And then we take, you know, a huge carbon cost. It feels bad. You go to this place in the middle of nowhere. And because of the climate crisis, the behavior didn't happen. There was too much rain and the polar bears sat and watched as the char swam past them. They couldn't catch them and we didn't get a sequence. So we went to the other ends of the earth and we saw just what we've been doing to this planet, and we're part of it, but we came home empty-handed.
Yeah.
And that's happening more and more.
Yeah. Which is, I mean,
bringing it home. So that's heartbreaking. That's really tough.
Absolutely.
Makes it more important.
Well, and it also goes to show, I mean, obviously it's heartbreaking from the planet's point of view, our point of view, and what the message there. What I like about you telling that is it just goes to show that it doesn't matter how many resources you have. It still doesn't mean that things are just going to work out. Just because you might have the backing of money and a network and the right gear and the right people and helicopters, and you can still come home empty-handed.
We didn't have helicopters. We had float planes, though.
Okay, all right. Well, no, you should have had helicopters.
But it was, and I think that those, you've got to be prepared for failure and for not bringing home the shot. And that hurts. It really hurts when you come home with not the sequence that you all wanted. And it would be a lie to pretend that every shoot is a success. They're not. And the failing of is as important as the making of.
Absolutely. How often, this is a silly question, but this is something I suffer from sometimes. My knees fail me these days, my back. Down on a sidewalk, filming a black bear, right? Trying to do some great behavior. And then I move and I nudge the tripod, right? As the behavior is happening, you know, kick the bottom of the tripod. How often are you doing silly mistakes like that? I want to know just personally, because I do them all the time.
I would like to think that you always make, listen, anyone who doesn't make an error is lying, who says that they don't. We all make mistakes. Here's what I learned about being and making mistakes. Own up to them really quickly. Don't pretend.
Right.
And that's not true. But I think that I've dropped a camera on my head. I had it on my roof. I had a mount on my roof. Really sorry, but this was years ago. So
no, fine. You're not going to get a bill from the BBC.
But I had a bowl on the car roof, and I was driving myself, and I had the camera, and I hadn't tightened the bottom bolt, and I went over a bump, and the bloody camera came and just whacked me on the head.
Oh.
And I was so embarrassed. I immediately stopped. I took stock of the camera. Camera's fine. My head had a divot taken out of it. But I was concussed, but the camera was okay. But the absolute humiliation, every camera person I know has a story about where they did something ridiculous. As you say, less and more, the creakiness is beginning to kick in. I'm going to just live in denial.
And good, keep there you go, okay.
Keeping as fit as I can. I'm a vegetarian, have been for 30 years. I think I'm winning.
You're okay. Perfect. Okay. Last silly question before we almost finish. How often do the editors hear you cussing on your footage when they're in the edit? Oh, they don't.
You know why? I shoot off speed.
Ah, so no audio.
None. When you're shooting long lens, even when you're shooting normal speed, you very rarely shoot on speed. I never shoot anything on speed ever, except if it's a big wide, and then I might.
Sure. Okay. So are you typically like six? Okay. So you typically like 60 frames a second or something? I mean, is it you vary?
I vary. It's absolutely up to the shot size. So if I'm super, super tight, it might be 60 to take the edge off. If it's an eyeball, it might be 60. If it's a foot, it might be 40. If it's just an animal walking, it might be 30, 32. It just depends. It's something I've got to know in the past through experience and shot size and the animal you're working with. If it's a little thing, if it's a big thing, what are you trying to say with the shot? So you can change the tone of what you're filming by your speed. But what's really funny is if I now see something shot at normal speed, I find it too fast. I'm like, So no one's ever going to hear anyone within like half a mile might hear me shrieking if I, if something goes wrong.
Well, I have to take a note from your book and do more. Off speed, because I have to apologize whenever I send drives in and say, I'm really sorry, you're gonna find there's a lot of moments in there where I'm cussing trying to stand up and my back's giving me problems.
I'll just shoot off speed and you're sort it all out.
There you go. Great. Perfect. Fantastic. Okay, finally, in terms of giving advice to people who are aspiring filmmakers, I think most of the people who listen to us are already making films. They've got a camera, they're aspiring to get into the industry, to really be part of this and, learn from people like yourselves. What would be, say, one piece of advice just across the board? If you were starting in this industry today and you were kind of confused about what the heck to do to be found, to be noticed, to really break into the industry, what advice would you have for them?
I would say do your research, actually. I would say prove it, because it's really easy to say, I want to be a wildlife filmmaker. It's so easy. Anyone can say it. But the people who tend to be wildlife filmmakers are the ones who do it, whether they get their footage shown or not. So do it. Get out the door and make those films. Doesn't matter if nobody sees them, but that makes you a wildlife filmmaker.
Absolutely.
Not the people saying, I want to be. The guy washing my hair with the gloves on saying he wants to be a wildlife filmmaker, I don't think so.
No, that's right.
You know,
I agree.
Everybody says they want to be a wildlife filmmaker. I want to do a game show on it. It would be a great game show. So you think you want to be a wildlife filmmaker.
Right.
In all the situations that we're in. But yeah, no, seriously, just and also look at the films that you're and what, you know, note who you like and who you don't like. And then those are the people you should be looking at to get in touch with. Know who they are. Know who are the bosses of the company who make the films and the camera people who make the films that you like. Nobody in the industry likes it more when they come up and go, oh, my God, I loved it when you did that.
Right.
The producers adore it, as they should, because we're all a part of it.
Yes, absolutely. So no, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah,
no, I could not agree more.
And just prove it. Just get out and blooming well do it. You know, do that thing.
And you got to. I mean, passion is probably overused, but you know, you've got to be passionate about it in the first instance to show that you want to do it. And as I say, with someone like Patrick Dykstra, who is out there filming whales because he loved being out there with whales on his own with his camera. And then now he's doing it and he's being paid to do it. He's not paying to do it anymore. He's being paid to do it. And that's the difference. But it took him years and years and years, like yourself, like myself, like so many of us in this industry, years of spending our own money, years of working for free, years for doing pro bono work, years of just getting, you know, getting our foot in the door to make it a reality. So I couldn't agree more.
Absolutely, Jake. I agree. Yeah, as you say, passion's an overused, but a pretty accurate word.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Sophie, where are you off to next? Are you able to tell us? Do you have things lined up?
In the UK. I am so excited because actually we have one hell of a country here to work in. And there is a lot going on right now here, which is fabulous. And I am off to spend a couple of weeks in the countryside. And I am super looking forward to it because I live in London. So I'm going to go and I'm going to live the dream and get out there. And that's an absolute example. I'm filming something that is very unglamorous, but hopefully we'll make it spectacular and brilliant.
Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And, you know, I think slowly the world is opening back up now and we're able to start looking at kind of traveling again and getting back to work. Yeah.
I'm working. You had Janet Van Vissering on the other week and I'm part of a team called Queens. And we're making a wonderful 6 1-hours on a female perspective in nature. And myself and Justine Evans are the co-DPing it. We're both DPing it, which is fantastic because that's how we do it. And we've got 6 fabulous 1 hours. And we are actively as well mentoring women into craft. So we've got Tanya Esteban and Tanya Escobar. Excuse me. I am so sorry. 2 Tanyas, would you believe? And
right.
Esteban is wonderful, but we're working with Tanya Escobar from Mexico and Erin Rani from Alaska as our mentees. And also with Faith Musembi in Kenya and various other people throughout the world. And it's going to be on Nat Geo or maybe even Disney Plus in 2023. So there you go.
Fantastic. Well, wonderful. It's always nice to be able to hear about what people are doing. So much of the time in this industry, we just can't talk about what we're doing.
Unless we shouldn't talk about it, but you know, don't tell
anyone. Right. We won't tell Janet, okay?
No, you can tell Janet. I love Janet. She's awesome.
Fantastic. Well, it's been, Sophie, a pleasure having you here on the show. Thank you so much. I could chat with you for hours, so we'll probably have to have you back at another time and talk about the projects you've been working on.
Well, once Queens is done, we'll be back on. I'll come back on with Erin or Tanya or Faith.
There you go. Well, I've been chatting with Erin about having her on the show. So
she is magic, that woman. I love her.
Hoping to have her on very soon.
She's such an inspiration, and she is, hands down, she is so impressive. So get her on.
Well, wonderful. Now, if people want to follow you, find out what you're doing, see some amazing pictures of you in the field. Where do they find you online?
Well, I think, as you know, that they can't see anything we do in the field because we sign NDAs. So we're not allowed one thing. So you'll see pictures of ducks or films from years ago.
Right.
But Sophie D Wildlife is my Instagram. And I have no idea what my Twitter is. It'll be something like, who does Twitter anymore anyway?
The pigeon.
Yeah. But if people want to send my emails, my website should work to send me. And I'm very happy always to critique, as I'm sure you are, showreels, but as long as they're less than 3 minutes.
More than that, perfect. Well, that's great to know. And I think that's very valid for people looking to put showreels together. Keep them short and sweet.
And make sure every shot counts. Every shot. I want
perfect.
To know why
they're there. Great advice. Thank you so much. I'll put your links up on our on the webpage for your episode. We'll put the links in there so people can find you. And thank you again. It's been a pleasure.
My absolute pleasure. Good luck. Take care now.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, then please leave a rating and a comment. And remember to subscribe to keep up to date with the series' future episodes. You can find out more information about wildlife filming at jakewillers.com. And if you're interested in starting a career in the wildlife filmmaking industry or being mentored to further your career, then please visit jakewillers.com/mentorship. Thanks for listening.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast. Now, with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.